you know, was probably about 17-18% in the UK in terms of all online shopping. You know, that's shot up to over 33% in the last couple of months. So we've seen probably a generation of change in the space of 3 months, and it's not going back.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 65 of the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. Today, I'm joined by Rory O'Connor from Scurry. Rory has a fascinating story to tell, but you're going to learn 3 main things. Number one, you're going to learn how to build a major technology business outside of a major city, so not in Dublin, Cork, Limerick or Galway. You're going to learn how to pivot when things are really not going well and how to communicate that to other stakeholders. Number three, you're going to learn how to raise significant levels of funding, and Rory steps us through the guide and the pathway to achieving that. This is episode 65 with Mr. Rory O'Connor from Scurry. Rory, welcome to the pod.
Thanks very much, Gary.
And we're doing a COVID-era pod of Zoom.
Yeah, no face-to-face today.
No, we'll have a pint or a coffee sometime in the future. So it's good to virtually meet you. Anyway, we've been in touch for a while. It's good to actually sit down and have a chat with you.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
So what's been, we'll get the COVID chat out of the way quickly. What's been life like for you personally and professionally since March?
Yeah, so two different worlds, I suppose. On a professional basis, we're in the e-commerce space. We're in the tools for e-commerce. E-commerce is booming. We're seeing our customers, grow. Most of our customers, that is, grow, really strongly. Of course, there are some always winners and losers. There are a small number that are struggling. But the vast majority are growing and growing fast. So overall, since March, we'd be seeing over a 55% increase in our volumes going through the platform. And we're seeing, a huge amount of new customers coming on board. So, it's been, the cloud always has a silver lining for somebody. We just happen to be in the right place at the right time. We're well set up at the moment. So that's from the professional point of view. I suppose from the personal point of view, like everybody else, it's been challenging. There was a number, I think, for about 3 months I had gone no more than a couple of kilometers from the house. My wife used to, dash to the shop. So I was left, lots of times without leaving the house for maybe a week or so, because there was any opportunity to go, she was in the car and gone. So, which is strange for somebody that was traveling to the UK nearly every week and beyond. Literally went from, constant travel to full stop.
Yeah, I asked someone this yesterday and they thought it was a very unusual question. What was, pre-COVID and post-COVID, what were the major changes for you, travel?
Yeah, travel, because, I've kind of from the, probably pre kind of Zoom era in my career and, very much, meeting people in person, it's kind of key to my own kind of personal philosophy, I suppose, in terms of doing business. So, meeting people is really important. We had lots of events, visiting customers important, visiting connections, partners, etc. So, spend a lot of time, actually physically meeting people. And of course, that all stopped. So, it meant a huge change, I suppose, for me. Some of it is brilliant. So being able to be at home for a consecutive streak of, 4 or 5 months and actually being at the dinner table every evening with your family is fantastic.
Yeah.
The amount of new probably people that I've met over the period is absolutely, fallen completely. And, for business, it's all about connections. So that has to be made up some other way, and that's a challenge, I suppose.
Yeah, we'll circle back on that, because that's actually something I'm really keen to dig into with you, because we briefly talked about it before the pod, as how you meet new people. But take me back to where it all started for you. Was this your first venture, or how did you get into this?
Yeah, it was my first venture. So previously, I started my, working life working for Waterford Crystal in Waterford. It was part of Waterford Wedgwood PLC. I started in sales and marketing, various sales and marketing roles. I was lucky enough to get involved in a project team, implemented SAP, and kind of got on the tech bus and never got off then. So I'm not a true techie. I was kind of a project lead, did some certification and configuration of SAP, and kind of got into the background of how the software development lifecycle and all that kind of stuff works. And from then on, you know, I had been involved in tech and various roles after that, including working for AOL. And I formed Scurry, I suppose, in 2010. And it was a slightly different model to what we're doing now. But there's this kind of, you know, itch that I had to scratch in terms of doing something myself that I kind of always had, but always kind of ended up having, you know, moved on to the next thing every maybe 2 years or so. So, you know, you're kind of progressing along in your career, and it was always put to the back burner for a long time. But eventually in 2010, decided that it was time to make that leap and started Scurry. So first time founder with Scurry, you know, lots of different and interesting experiences before.
So what changed? What changed in 2010 to make you make that leap? Because I know that's a lot of thing. That's one major thing that holds people back. They're like, oh, you know, I've got on the career bus now. I've been, you know, 9-10 years. I've put in the hard yards. I'm just getting to where I think I should be. So what changed for you?
I suppose we're kind of a point in time where you're saying, if you're going to do it, now is the time to do it, or I might never do it. I think that was more so. You know, we were starting to go deep into recession at the time. I was kind of looking at, you know, my next probably career might mean moving to Dublin. I've always kind of lived outside of Dublin, or to London at the time. We actually were seriously looking at a role in London. And I had just started a new family, young family. So we're kind of going, really want to go and kind of up sticks and move to London. And once the job was good and interesting, kind of said, no, I think, you know, now's the time to do my own thing. I think my wife probably thought I had a midlife crisis at the time. Kind of, yeah, you might do that for a few months and kind of go back to the real world.
He's going to take up golf or buy a motorbike instead.
Yeah.
So where did the idea come from? You know, wanting to own your own business is where a lot of us start, but I think a lot of people struggle with the ideas. Where did your idea come from?
Yeah, I think there was actually a lot of ideas that I kind of had over time, you know, kind of wondering whether that would work. But I had done a piece of work for a company called Euronix, and their white goods kind of buying group. And it was basically getting kind of handle on in-store stock for online buying. And the kind of, you know, walking around the warehouses, kind of saw that it was still challenging for people to get deliveries. And that kind of started the kind of embryo of the kind of thought process. And then at the time, I was also kind of, I suppose, eBay. I was buying lots of bits and pieces. I was very much into triathlon, kind of cycling and upgrading my bike at the time. And I was buying lots of bits and pieces online. And just thought that there was a gap in the kind of delivery space right across the board, from consumers buying stuff and trying to get, you know, kind of trying to get products, and for businesses in the delivery space. And then on the other side, there was a huge amount of excess capacity in the delivery space. So empty trucks rolling around the place. And I just wondered, was there any way to kind of match one with the other? And that was the original idea for Scurry, was to kind of match people who were looking for delivery, whether individual consumers or businesses, with excess capacity that was going around in the network.
So you had this kind of idea, a rough kind of idea, could I match this with that? Where did you start then? Because that seems like a big idea. So where did you start to kind of piece that together?
Yeah, so the first thing that I did is I went on the Enterprise Platform Program, which is New Frontiers nowadays. I think it was called SEEP at the time then in WIT. Mm. I think anyone that goes on an accelerator or one of those platform programs, or, you know, it's a good idea, because you're right, where do you start? If you haven't been involved in it, and, you know, it's one of the things about being an entrepreneur is, where do you start? Where do you find out what to do? And, you know, no, he didn't have all the answers. He just kind of had this kind of mad idea. How am I going to get this done? So, I joined that in WIT. And that was good because it kind of gave you some kind of initial frameworks to work with. And I think I was really lucky at the time. Enterprise Ireland were running a program at the time, which was a kind of an accelerator program. And I jumped on that. And there were some really good mentors on that. People like Eric Reese were actually on that. And we just got some really good insights into how they were doing it in San Francisco. And that helped, I think, with kind of going, okay, I could do this maybe.
So how did you enter the accelerator program, and what was your kind of kernel of the idea then? What were you trying to achieve out of that? What was your MVP? Because, a lot of people kind of like, oh, I have this idea on a whiteboard sitting in front of me, but I don't know how to get that into someone's hand or on their truck or whatever it is.
Yeah. Well, I suppose in one way, I was lucky in that, often being the interface between the technology people and the business people in my previous roles for probably the previous 10 years, that wasn't as much a challenge for me. So, drawing out a Word diagram and maybe not knowing how to code it, but knowing what needed to be done, an experience that I had already picked up. So I was able to kind of frame out and map out what needed to be done and kind of build, some flows. And I went to originally a guy that I had worked with in AOL and asked Mark, would he kind of come on board and help me build a prototype? So, that's what we did, built a prototype and presented it initially to a few customers and to Enterprise Ireland to try and kind of kick off that process. That's very much get it onto some kind of sheets of paper and kind of get some kind of flows and course, talk to customers. And I suppose I had been good at that because that's what I used to do was, talk to the end users and try and translate that into some kind of, something that the developers could actually work with.
So what was your version one? What was your first version product? Who were the customers?
Yeah, first version was very much focused on people who were buying on eBay and Dundeal. And we went away from business, even though the original idea was maybe to have business. We just said we'd focus in on consumers because there wasn't anybody really satisfying that. And we signed up about 600 transport providers, one-man van majority, up to some of the national kind of pallet providers, etc. But lots of small players. And we managed to convince Fred Carlson and Dundeal at the time to actually kind of get onto the platform, and that started us off. So it was very much focused on consumers, very much kind of getting kind of space for the excess capacity and getting and kind of reselling that in arbitrage model. And,
okay.
That was the original MVP.
So if someone was coming, say, from Wexford to Dublin, half a van empty, you were able to connect them with the guy who actually needed something shipped up and take advantage of that.
Yeah.
And how did you get your first couple of clients? Where did they come from?
First couple of clients was a local guy. So our first, I only passed by his door the other day. The first truck was a local guy who had a steel erection company, and he was often bringing steel to a site, coming back, with an empty truck.
Ah, yes.
So he heard what I was doing and he signed up. And then somebody locally needed a porta cabin actually, and they kind of moved, they bought a porta cabin. So our first actual paying transaction was for a porta cabin to be moved about 10 miles or so, 20 miles maybe. And that was our first one. So, and that was so satisfying.
You always remember. That's why I always ask everyone. Everyone remembers that first one.
Yeah, actually somebody paid for it. Yeah, it was fantastic.
There's very few things as sweet as that first one. You always remember that little first deal. And what was the next, what was the goal? Like, did you need a lot of money to build it, or was it, you were trying to build out a platform? Was it a consumer facing platform?
Yeah, so you do. And, I suppose not realizing that at the beginning. So look, in some ways being an entrepreneur and being kind of fresh into it, you know, if you probably knew what you didn't know, you might never do. you need an awful lot of money to have a consumer-facing proposition. Mm-hmm. It needs, stacks of cash to do that. And we didn't have it, but we didn't know that we needed that amount of cash. So mm-hmm. we just kind of kept going. So we got a grant from the Wexford Local Development Agency, which was 12K or something. And I really remember that was probably, again, we raised over 8 million at the moment. So that was probably the most satisfying round to close ever, because it was the first time that somebody put any kind of faith in you.
Yeah.
And I remember just, getting that, getting that check and being, absolutely over the moon about it. It was just, fantastic to get it.
That little bit of validation that, like, oh, yeah, someone else believes too. Yeah. I'm not crazy.
Yeah.
And that's what a lot of people go for is they think, oh, consumer facing platform, that's a great, let's do it. And I don't think anyone realizes the amount of money it takes to reach people, because it's so hard to reach individual people. When did you come to that realization that it was getting very tough to reach people?
Yeah, it probably took us a couple of years, really, because we had the initial successes. So we got, we got transactions and we got onto the platform and done deals. So we had that access, and in fairness to Fred Carlson, he was very good to us, and, he was very pro-entrepreneur, and, probably if you had to pay full, whack for the access, he kind of gave very discounted kind of rates in terms of, allowing us to use ads and, almost free ads for a while to get us going and that. Mm. So, he was very good. But, after a while, you kind of realize that, paid advertising, trying to get, get consumers in, how hard it is to build up an SEO profile. Growth hacking was just emerging at the time, so it wasn't as prevalent, as it was. So remember at that time just going with hearing the first, I think 2010 growth hacking was coined, the term was coined in 2010. So that's when we had started. So, we were kind of, it wasn't so kind of obvious that, following, kind of new channels might, get you kind of growth maybe. And, at the time, Facebook was growing extremely fast, but, we got some decent customers in terms of volumes, but one of the issues we had was that there was a lot of customer service issues with the model, because we had taken on board lots of small persons, one man in the van, and to be honest, some of them had been thrown out of the carrier companies for not hitting their SLAs. So right. The reason that they hadn't got work was because maybe they hadn't hit the standards that some of the nationwide carriers expected of them. So gotcha. We had lots of customer service issues, and it became unsustainable actually after a while.
So the first 2-3 years, was that self-funded then, or did you have to go get more funding, or how were you kind of sustaining the business for the first couple of years?
Yeah, we, myself and business partner, Eugene, put in over 100,000 between the two of us, a bit more than 110,000 or something. We had got a grant from Wexford Local Development. We actually got the grant in from the County Enterprise Board, and then we got on the Competitive Start Program, which was the very first tranche of the Competitive Start Program from EI. And then we had a couple of angel investors then as well. Pat Nolan particularly had joined us kind of early on, has been a really strong investor of us right throughout our entire journey. And we managed to get, some funding together, not massive amounts, but it managed to keep us going and keep the team going for the first couple of years.
So did it reach a point where you were like, oh, we need to tweak something here, or how did you decide to kind of go in a different direction with it then?
Yeah. So, you know, it just became obvious that, you know, the customer service levels, we were trying, we thought we might get to solve it. We were experimenting with different things and, you know, it just didn't work. And we kind of came to the realization, one, with the consumer model, the amount of capital that was required and the likelihood of raising that capital in the time frame that we needed with the evidence that we had was probably unlikely. The customer service issues had to be dealt with. So we actually sat down and pivoted, and we actually went through an exercise where we said, look, what have we got? What could it be? I think we boiled it down into four different options that we could actually kind of pivot into. We analyzed each of those. We knew we couldn't afford to test, you know, all four, and we just basically analyzed it as much kind of research as we could in a couple of days. And, then decided that we were going to, you know, change the model that we're going to change to now. I think one of the biggest influences was a guy called Vinnie O'Brien, and Vinnie was working for eBay at the time, and he had said to me, just kind of in passing, we had a conversation. We were kind of tracked a lot of eBay customers as well as Dundee, and he said, you should have a look at the UK retail B2B market. There's a monopoly over there with a company which, in his view, you know, didn't do a great job, and that there was an opportunity for another entrant in there, and that was doing what we do now, you know, servicing the retailers. And I went over and had a look and did some research. The research was good in that everybody said, yeah, we'd love to see some competition. And there isn't really a huge amount of competition. And the partners, carrier partners, also said the same. So we kind of, when we ticked all, we went through all the boxes, big market, you know, we have some of the technology that we can kind of adapt into it. There's a incumbent that has a kind of monopoly position, but, you know, could be kind of knocked over, et cetera, et cetera. We kind of went through all the kind of scoring. It came out way on top of everything else. We decided to pivot based on that.
So to the layman, what were the company in the UK doing?
Yeah, so basically, it's a service that allows retailers to choose and plug in whichever carrier or delivery option that they would like. So a single API that gives you access to all of the carriers. And if you think of it, depending on where of what Stripe does for payments, yes. You know, a single kind of platform that gives you access to all the payments and then gives you tools on top of that.
Gotcha.
Basically, we're a Stripe for shipping, if you think of it in that.
I like that. That's going to make a note of that. That's a good way to summarize it. Okay, you're pivoting from scratch. Was there ever a moment where you're like, are we going to keep going with this, lads? Do you sit around the table kind of looking at each other sideways going, so who's going to say it?
This is one of the kind of lonely things about being a CEO. You have to be confident, but taking long walks on the beach, because we were right beside the beach at the time. We got a lovely, fantastic office in a fort in Duncannon with a drawbridge and everything.
Amazing. So, you know, fantastic. Metaphorically works in this context as well.
Absolutely, yeah. A moat, yeah. We had our own moat. It wasn't a technical moat, but it was a real one.
The lads just locked in there, just looking at each other going, right, we can't leave until we figure this out.
Yeah, and you know, going for a walk on the beach going, God, you know, I've taken all this money off people. One, you know, we've, you know, kind of not worked out. I've convinced all these people to come and work with me, and it's not working out. It's, you know, we've climbed a big hill and now we've got to go right back to the bottom and just kind of start again. And we had done this in between two. We were on monthly board meetings at the time. We had a board meeting and I had to give the bad news at the last board meeting that it wasn't working to our investors. And I had to go back to, you know, a month later with a plan. And you're going, well, this is the best plan, but no, still lots to be done here. Mm. Can we actually do it? So, yeah. But externally, you can't show that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, certainly you're not supposed to anyway, I think. But, you know, you don't want people abandoning kind of, if you're not confident, you know, how would they be confident in your leadership, et cetera. So, you know, challenging time. Yeah.
But I like hearing successful founders talk about that, because it's often, like we joked about it before, you know, the 10-year overnight success.
Yeah.
You know, people look back and they retrofit success onto their journey, especially the early days. Oh, we had this great idea and bang, you know, it just fit to market. And you're just like, oh, lads, come on, stop the spin, you know. So it's good to, and I think that reassures a lot of people, especially now when people are probably having this exact conversation. And I kind of identify with your long, lonely walks as well. It started COVID. I was like, just go down to the beach here and I'd be like, walk long gone right, what are the options here? And you just have to, you have to project confidence to your clients, to your staff, yeah, to everybody else. But inside, it can be lonely. So it's interesting to hear that. So when you decided to pivot, then you weren't starting from scratch, but how did you then approach, you know, okay, brand new, it's not a new industry, but a brand new kind of business for yourselves? Like, what did you have to do?
But once you make the decision, you know, it's great. The worst thing you're doing is kind of in the middle of this kind of no man's land, because once you make the decision and you start, then it brings back the energy, yeah, you know? And you know what, somewhat the team probably didn't see that, because, you know, we were doing exercises and kind of research. And, you know, I remember the big wall we had with all the kind of different options up there, and we're analyzing them. But really, once you get, you know, for me personally, then once I knew what I was doing, then you've taken the first step, and that's the first step on the road. And then it's just back to, you know, you kind of have confidence again. You go, okay, I know what I'm doing. Look, I just have to get there now. And then, you know, that kind of time, you know, kind of doubt, and that kind of goes away to some extent. And I didn't, you know, I don't know if that sounds crazy or something, but that's just, you know, kind of the way it was for me, is that, okay, now there was lots to do, but we knew where we were going. You had a kind of vision to go to, and now it was only about kind of finding the path. So, I mean, just to do the basics, you had to go out and talk to customers again. So, you know, the really interesting thing is you talk to customers and say, yeah, I'd love that. And then you come and say, will you buy it off me? And then they go, oh, well, but, you know, you need to have another customer, because I'm not going to get sacked. Because
the chicken and egg, yeah.
the first one. But look, that's then, you know, you kind of go, we knew there was a gap. We knew it was big. We knew we had a lot of work to do. And, you know, we just kind of kept plugging, and we just had a bit of luck where we were working with Fastway as a carrier. They had a customer that wanted to integrate with the competitor. They gave them a timeline of, you know, sometime next year. We said we could do it in a couple of weeks. Okay. And we got the customer. That was first step, you know.
Was that a case of tapping existing contacts or going out knocking on doors again? Or how did you start then the whole customer acquisition journey again?
Yeah, a combination of both, because we had been working on the previous model with Fastway. So we had, and they knew what we were doing, knew our, you know, our credentials and our credibility. And we had, you know, so, you know, a lot wasn't wasted, because they saw how we worked, you know, the way that we were, you know, we did what we said. We were very professional, what we did. And even though it didn't work for them, and they were hoping to get, you know, lots of new customers through that channel, even though it didn't, they kind of looked and said, look, these guys, you know what they're talking about, and they do what they say. So when the opportunity came up and the competitor couldn't do it, they just went, hey, we talked to these guys, and we managed to get the customer onboarded. And then the funny thing is, when we realized that, is that we realized that the old platform that we built wasn't going to sustain the volumes, because it was built for individual customers, single volumes, and architected for that. And now we were looking at a single customer doing lots of volume. And, you know, our process and everything had to change. So we literally, over the next 6 months, then nearly had to throw out everything and rebuild from the beginning, in some, to some extent. But we knew what we had to build, whereas I suppose the first time we didn't know what we had to build.
I know what you mean. You weren't starting from scratch. You had the rough blueprint for a different kind of machine, but just had to tweak it. So yeah. What happened in the next kind of 12 months? Let's see, you're right. Pivot month one. What was the next 12 months like?
Yeah. So, I mean, next 12 months, I mean, was really about getting customers and getting validation. So getting that first customer again was really important. And then once we got that customer, you kind of ended up getting another one, and, you know, another one after that. So I think, the huge issue was getting the, you know, the platform, getting replatformed at the time. So it was all around kind of, I suppose, keeping up what we had and making sure that, you know, we didn't disappoint the customer. and you know, getting the tech right to, you know, bring on more customers, really. And as we were bringing them on, making sure that we didn't kind of lose them. And in comparison to where we are today, you know, I remember we'd have outages, and the customers wouldn't even know about these outages, but we'd have outages, we'd have problems, you know, and often the customers didn't even know about them, but, you know, we're up all night, we were kind of getting all these things fixed. We were hand manually doing stuff that the customer didn't know that we were doing manually in the background.
Standard startup stuff, just making it work, just getting there. Google Sheets, no, plugging into your Gmail, plugging into this, plugging into that. Yeah, look, exactly. We've all been there. And then, exactly. So when did you start to feel the traction, the momentum behind you after that first year, and you're like, okay, this is actually starting to work. We've hit something good here.
Yeah, I mean, we started to hit traction, but actually there was another set of challenges. So, and the next set of challenges were that, We integrate carriers, and each of the carriers are actually, there's no standards in the industry. So unlike Stripe, where there's a banking industry and banking standards, in this industry, there's actually zero standards. So there's no standard at all. So carrier A develops their technology in one way, and carrier B does it completely different.
I get you. No, okay.
Yeah. So as we kind of increase the integrations, the first one, you know, was easy. The second one, maybe was a little bit more difficult because we had two, but now we had to think of three different, we had an architect the system for the third one, and you can't go out and research it without kind of really getting into the integration because there's no standards. The documentation generally was poor at the time. And some of them, you know, didn't even have APIs and actually still don't have APIs. So you're using kind of all kinds of different technologies. So we ended up thinking, you know, that and forecasting that, you know, based on the first two, that it's going to take us a certain amount of time to, you know, get the technology kind of base in and get kind of a critical mass of carriers. And it took a lot longer for us. And what actually happened is then we had to start diverting money that we were planning to put into sales and marketing and customer acquisition into getting the platform. And we had to be very, I suppose, careful with cash. And we probably had to forsake growth to some extent to get to product market fit. But we knew, we just had this belief that if we could get volume of carriers and we kept our system good and solid from the learning we had in the first year, that it was a long game. We had to play the long game rather than trying to maybe push growth, get customers in and lose them and churn them. And for a lot of, for getting further rounds of funding, it became harder because we didn't have the growth numbers that particular investors were looking for. And we probably had to take on cash at, I suppose at times a lot less than we would have liked to have. And maybe, you know, at terms that, you know, we would have preferred to have better terms, but we weren't making those kind of magic numbers for those investors. But we really believed that the long game was that if we could get to critical mass of carriers and keep our quality right, we were going to win the customer, and it was the only way.
I think deliveries are like, it's like a restaurant with a bad meal. No one talks about the 100 great meals. It's just that one bad meal. Same with delivery. If you get your delivery right 100 times and then suddenly one day it's delayed, people are losing their minds.
Absolutely. It is. And, you know, the, you know, retailers' queries, you know, are somewhere 30 to 50% of queries into retailers, online retailers, is where is my order?
Wow.
So, yeah. So if it goes wrong, you know, it drives huge amount of costs in terms of the even just customer service calls.
I guess Amazon have probably shifted the market as well, have they, with their expectation levels of delivery?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely have. And, you know, the amount of money they have spent on logistics is phenomenal.
Mm. And how does that fit with you guys then? Where do they sit in terms of your model? Are they a competitor or a potential client, or what way does it work?
So we would do, they're another partner for us. So Amazon, obviously have the new Amazon Logistics, which is an integration we have. So you can, you know, use Amazon Logistics through our platform, or if you want to be fulfilled by Amazon, you can you know, you can plug in through Scurry. So that it just gives you the opportunity. We just see them as another partner delivery option, or a platform that you can integrate into to get deliveries done for.
Okay, you touched on it there in terms of raising money and your long-term vision. So it's often a very differing vision. So investors are in for an X period of time with an expectation of return on X period of time. And then the founder is often thinking 10, 20, 30 years. If they're a very good founder, they're thinking very, very long-term terms. How did you balance those two?
Well, the two, you know, they can't be unbalanced, right? So because you've got to, if you're, you know, your step to the way I like to look at it is you've got a long-term vision. Our vision, we call it connecting commerce. And what connecting commerce is about is, you know, we really believe that when a parcel gets into somebody's hands, that's the world of, you know, bits and bytes being turned into the physical world. So it's the, you know, it's that translation. And it's the, we believe it's probably the most important moment to some extent, because it's when you realize your purchase. So, you know, you go into Brown Thomas to pay for something, you get it into your hand right there and then, and you realize the purchase. When you buy something online, you've never seen anything. You're looking into a computer screen. And then, you know, when you receive that parcel, I don't know if you see it at home, but I certainly see it with my kids, my wife, my family, that, you know, when the doorbell rings and there's a parcel expected, like just people are rushing down the stairs. And,
you during know, COVID, it kept me going. I was checking. I was ordering stuff just to be able to go out and get it. I was like, I was getting Amazon books. I was getting like sports deliveries. I was just like running out to the mailbox. I was like, oh, this is amazing. Because it's that little rush. You still get that little rush.
If that's it, that little rush you talk about, if we can make, you know, if we can do anything to make that a really good experience, that's our vision. So it's, you know, making sure that you get the tracking information, you know where it is, and to make sure that, you know, you get the right delivery, you get a reasonable delivery. And it's not just maybe a parcel being delivered to your house, that you can actually have it delivered to a locker, like a parcel motel, or you can get it delivered to a store in one of the parcel shop stores. Or you get click and collect. So any way that the parcel or the object gets to you, we want to be making that easy for the retailer to get you as a consumer the right delivery. So that's our vision. It's our long term vision. Then we have a mission, which is, you know, to, you know, whatever it is for the next year or two, and our mission up to now was to get to EBITDA positive, and we're very close to that at the moment. So that was, you know, kind of our 2-year mission. So we have a vision, we have a mission. And, you know, the mission, and we're trying to align that with our investors, and, you know, it's up to us then to convince new investors that it's the right one, you know, that that's the next step. And I think before, maybe I was more worried about convincing the investors that I came to that are trying to see what did they want and try and work to that, instead of going, you know, we really believe that, you know, we want to get to our vision. Our mission is the next step, and convince the investors that, and actually go for those investors that buy that story rather than trying to convince somebody that you want to get because you think they're the, you know, they're the investor that you want on your cap table.
So a lot of people listen to the pod are kind of aspiring entrepreneurs or kind of early stage entrepreneurs, possibly looking to raise money. So what would your advice be to them based on your own journey? How you guys have raised, is it 8 million you touched on?
Yeah.
So that's a lot of money. Like, so how did you go from your pivot in 2013, which was not that long ago, 2020, you've now raised 8 million?
Yeah. So a different way than, you know, some people have, you know, kind of, you know, hit the right sweet spot. They've got the traction, you know, the technology is just right. And they manage to, you know, get those kind of nice numbers for investors, and they can get, you know, 5 million after raising a seed round. So they raise a seed round, maybe get 1 million or, you know, 500,000 or something. And suddenly can get, you know, a series A of 5 to 7 or something away. That's fantastic if you can, and that you can actually do that. But for those of you that maybe can't do that because a bit more work to do, you know, bigger moat to build or stuff like that, I think you need to look for investors that are willing to play the long game, that are not going to just give you a check and then not follow on and abandon you if you don't hit those magic numbers. I think you need to research that you get the right that you get the right investor. I would strongly urge people to, you know, if they're talking to an investor, to do their DD on them, as they'll do on you. You know, find out who they've invested in before. Don't ask the VC. Go have a look at their, you know, just have a look at their pages. Ring those founders and ask them what was their experience. And
that's good advice, because you actually, that's the first time I've asked this question a lot. That's the first time someone said that, is to do your due diligence on them. I think a lot of people are so happy that someone has shown an interest that they're like, oh yes, come on in, and then eventually it can lead to friction, or as you say, you know, they haven't done their DD on them. So that's great advice, I think, is to chat to other people, chat to other founders.
Yeah, because, you know, it's like a wedding or marriage, you know. You know, you've got to be with these investors for a period of time, you know, so until, you know, they're bought out or there's an exit. So it could be anything to, you know, 5, 10, 15 years, maybe, you know, that you're going to work with these people. So, yeah, you're going to go on a few dates, aren't you, if you're going to, you know, if you're going to marry somebody.
So what do you look for in a good investor? What's your kind of like, you know, yes, good characteristic, yes. Is it personal, or do you have set specific things you're scoring off?
Yeah, for me, personal, you've got, you know, if you're going to work with somebody, and, you know, you've got to be able to have a relationship with that person. So that's important. And, you know, I find that's important in everything that I do. So I think, you know, particularly an investor, you know, that's really important. And I suppose the second thing I would look at is, I think you've got to know what you want to do, and then see, does that investor fit into that? So some, you know, some investment firms have the wherewithal to play the long game. So they have, you know, multiple funds. They've, you know, their experience is, you know, they like, you know, playing the long game. Check that out. See if that's something that you want to do. If you're, you know, if you've got everything in place, and, you know, you've got a fantastic product that's just, you know, going gangbusters, well then, you know, the ones that are looking for, you know, kind of the rapid turnaround could be good for you, because you're matched. So I think the most important thing is to kind of is the matching. And physically, I'm a great fan of physically meeting people. So I'm sitting down with somebody, having a coffee, having a pint with somebody, and saying, you know, could I actually do that again? Could I have a pint to that person?
Yeah.
I'm not talking about being friends, you know, being personal friends with somebody, but you've got to be able to pick up the phone when the chips are down and ring that person and go, we're having a problem. And, you know, what's your advice? Who can you point me in to help me actually solve this? And yeah.
It's the feeling of, are you looking forward to it, or are you dreading it? It's like,
yeah.
As you get a bit older as well, I think you get a little bit more self-confident, a bit more aware of how you're spending your time, because you know you only have X amount of it in a day or in a month or in a year. So I think it comes with that confidence, probably, of being a founder for quite a long time as well. You just get a bit of experience, don't you?
Yeah. Yes.
So you're based in Wexford. Let's talk about this a little bit, actually. Have you ever felt, oh, we need to move to Dublin or London, or has being in a regional centre helped you?
It helps and hinders. So, there's positive and negatives. You know, if you're starting out and saying, where's the perfect place? Like, you're not close to capital. We're not as close to our customers as if we were maybe somewhere in the UK, because a lot of our customers are in the UK. So those can be disadvantages. And perhaps just more so at the earlier stages, I think, because, you know, our plan is to be, you know, an international, if not global, business. And when I say international, I mean wildly international, as far flung as, you know, we have customers in Australia, Germany, US, UK. So, you know, I'm saying international rather than global, being in every, you know, kind of in every country at this stage. So, you know, when you're with plans to be an international company, no matter where you are, then you've got other countries that you've got to travel to if you're where your customers are. So I think in the initial stage, you know, because we have focused on the UK, there's huge opportunity in the UK. It's still a huge opportunity in the UK for us. You know, being a little bit away has had some challenges. And what that has meant is, you know, sometimes just personal sacrifices. So initially for a couple of years, I actually went Monday to Thursday to London every week.
Wow.
And that's what it meant. But from a family point of view, I didn't want to move the family. And, you know, we found people who were interested in living, really talented, and who were not interested in living in the city. Mm-hmm. So, you know, yeah, the positives then, you know, their costs are much lower, quality of life, you know, much, much better for those that are kind of working from the office. You also get a lot of kind of support locally. So, you know, even when we were doing renovating the office, you know, you'd ring the county council and say, look, we need a broadband line in. And, you know, they were very accommodating and kind of getting that organized in, you know, the shortest space possible, which was the forms to fill and, you know, what we needed to do, rather than just sending you off and saying that you're another one of thousands of businesses that are, you know, kind of in the city and, you know, which is at the back of the queue or something like that. So there is benefits.
Looking at the world now, you've cracked the code already. You've kind of moved out away from the cities. You've got probably, you know, a remote work setup happening inadvertently almost for years.
We found challenges with remote work, to be honest. So, you know, so we wouldn't describe ourselves as truly remote. So we have some people who work remotely. We have been centered up until now around the office, but up until COVID. We found, you know, initially, actually, in the first couple of years, we were remote and we came back to kind of having a strong base.
That's interesting. What brought you back?
Yeah, we just communicate, you know, communication issues, cultural issues. Just found very hard to keep everybody aligned, you know, when people were remote. So it's not about tasks and, you know, trusting whether people work or not, but actually the longer term, you know, building culture, vision, you know, kind of mission, stuff like that. Very challenging if people are not together. And we would say we're flexible from, you know, but office-based would be kind of rare. So if somebody wants to go home and work for a few days remotely, yeah, that's fine. But, you know, the center is the office. And I think it's hard to have the dual system because, you know, if some people are remote and some people are in the office, you've got a system where either one system or the other is better.
And us almost as well.
Yeah. So I just wonder whether you have to be fully remote, totally embrace and build all your processes and systems around that, or you need to be, you know, somewhat office centered.
That's interesting because obviously everything is spun around now. So everyone is suddenly remote. So what do you think once COVID kind of settles down, you think you'll stay with the current system?
I mean, our plan is to, you know, our current plan is not to change. You know, we found that this worked for us. Our current plan at the moment, as we're looking at it, is not to change. So we're going to kind of come back to the office. Some come back to the office and rotate and stuff like that to try and just kind of get people kind of back into the office somewhat. But, you know, if things get worse again, you know, we'll probably go back and go to remote and try and look at longer term. How do we deal with that? But the initial kind of thought process is, yeah, can we get back to, you know, what was good for us that we found has been good for us over the last period of time.
But clearly COVID has worked for you guys in terms of, I think you've had a very successful COVID compared to a lot of people, and you've even closed a funding round. Is that correct during COVID?
Yeah. So yeah, it has been, but for us, you know, somewhat that's just luck. We're in the right place at the right time. You know, if I had to start a company that was, you know, kind of a travel booking tech company, you know, yeah, things wouldn't be so maybe so great for us now. So we're in the right place at the right time. We're able to be flexible, like we can work from home, like it's not to be kind of hate or don't stop people from working home unnecessary. That's not the case. So I think COVID has been, you know, kind of really, really good for us. But it's just we're dealt good cards and we're playing them. And, you know, there is a bit of lady luck in it.
Lady luck, but also 10 years of hard graft and you're in the right place at the right time. The harder you work, the luckier that you get, as I think Roy Keane famously coined. Or his was fail to prepare, that. Prepare to fail. Yeah, it's true though. It is true. Like you have to be, if you'd given up 5 years ago, that's the luck wouldn't have been there. How did you, was it very difficult raising a funding round during COVID? I know you talked about luck there, but what was it different raising a funding round?
It wasn't hugely, to be honest, because this funding round was, the majority of our funders have been those that have supported us over the last number of rounds. So, you know, I think what has happened, you know, in the last couple of rounds is we found that we've got some really good supporters in our existing investor base. They see, you know, where we're going. They kind of are playing the long game, and they're, you know, once we hit, you know, milestones, they're supporting us. So we were hitting our milestones, and we got the support. I think, you know, with the success that we're seeing, we're definitely very well poised for, you know, kind of new investment, and, you know, probably a significant new investment. So we're probably going to go out to the market at the end of the year is the plan, and, you know, kind of raise a significant amount, you know, the kind of A size kind of round, okay. Typical A size round now. And the great thing now is that money will do a tremendous amount in comparison to in the past, because we're at a point where we're very close to EBITDA positive. So,
okay, you know, it's really going to move the needle.
That's a really good, you know, you can do a huge amount with that kind of money.
So e-commerce has obviously been exploding during COVID. What advice would you give to, say, smaller retailers or people who are trying to get into it now? You know, as someone who's very, very experienced in it, I think, you know, commerce will just be e-commerce. It'll just be, you'll be both. What advice would you give to people who maybe haven't that experience, who are now going, my shop's closed, I need to now move online?
Yeah. So, you know, we call it, we talk about commerce rather than e-commerce internally. We just, it's commerce, you know, e-commerce is commerce. It's the new commerce. And it's been heading that way, you know, for, you know, a number of years. So it, you know, was probably about 17-18% in the UK in terms of people who, you know, who shot all online shopping, you know, that shot up to over 33% in the last couple of months. So we've seen probably a generation of change in the space of 3 months, and it's not going back. We did a survey ourselves actually the last couple of weeks, and you know, most Brits are saying that they're going to continue to shop online at the kind of same levels that they had in the past. So I suppose for people that are wanting to go online, look at companies like Heinz. So Heinz went live with Shopify, big company like Heinz, in a week. So if you can, you know, and in, you know, for those that say, oh yeah, but they've got money, the bigger the company, the more complex it is.
Yeah.
And I just, you know that from implementing systems myself. So actually, as a smaller company, you probably, it's probably a little bit easier for you to actually, it's not about resources, it's about complexity, you know. So when you've got a large company, you've got a lot of complexity. And whilst, yes, you do need resources to go online and you need to invest in it, it is possible to get online very quickly and learn and adapt. And I think your customers like dealing with brands. And if you've done well as a physical store and you've treated your customers well, they're going to like to give you business, you know, in this new era. So what you've got to do is provide them with a mechanism to, you know, to buy from you. And I think you've got to do, you know, you've got to invest in that. So it can't be a poor experience, but if you can make it a decent experience, I think you're going to have, you can certainly replace some of those sales. And if you do it well, it could be a significant contributor to your success in the future.
A solid advice. Just one more, close to time to wrapping up, but just one more question before you go. Your clients, you've some of the biggest clients in the UK, if not globally. How did you secure them as a relatively smaller company back in the day?
Yeah, I think right place at right time, and kind of I think you're the harder to practice the luckier you get. So, you know, all of them were not one day kind of hit. So it was kind of presenting to them, maybe being told no, following up and saying, look, well, if there's ever an opportunity. And in all cases, there was something that just happened in all those customers that they needed somebody at a short notice to fix something. We got in you know, small, and the kind of land and expand mentality. I think you've got to have that. So, you know, eBay is one of our largest customers. We started with a very small project with them, which is a small division in the UK. And, you know, that's kind of multiplied over the years. And it's similar with most of our customers that, you know, you get in, they trial you with something because they have an opportunity. And then if you do a good job, you know, you're in.
I think that's great advice in terms of just go in, even if it's something small, do a cracking job, and then you'll get the follow-on trust.
Yeah.
Super. Listen, Rory, where can people learn a little bit more about yourself and a little bit more about Scurry?
Yeah, well, I'm on LinkedIn, so you can look me up as Rory O'Connor, and CEO of Scurry. So you can find me on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter at RT O'Connor. And if you want to check out Scurry, it's www.scurry.com.
Brilliant. Rory, have a great day. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Gary.
Thanks for coming on the pod. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was episode 65 with Rory O'Connor from Scurry. Don't forget, the Idea Lab comes out every Monday morning, and you should also jump on my website, Mr. Gary Fox, and join our newsletter, which accompanies that. I send out an email every Monday morning at 5 a.m. filling you in on all the stuff we talked about in the Ideas Lab and all the links to the articles we talk about. So go to mrgaryfox.com and join the newsletter. I will see you next week.